Okay, we've got what I think is a really good show for you, so let's get going. We want to thank Grass Valley Hydro Garden, serving the hydroponic and organic gardening needs of Nevada County since 2000. Grass Valley Hydro Garden offers sun system and hydroform lighting, organic soil, fertilizers, ventilation, and hydroponic systems. Grass Valley Hydro Garden, 12506 Loma Rica Drive, 530-477-2996. Thanks also to Planet Solar, providing renewable energy sales and service for homes, businesses, and public properties. Their specialties include site consultations, financial cost-benefit analyses, and project management for new construction and retrofits. www.planitsolar.com, 530-432-3776. All right, today's show for the 11th of November. David, do we have you on air?
Hi, good to be here.
Excellent. David Swanson, would you like to briefly introduce yourself?
I suppose so. I'm recently become a book author. I have a book out called Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union, which I wrote in sort of a break from activism and blogging and writing of shorter pieces, which is what I usually do. And I work on peace and justice and social need campaigns. I've been a reporter, I've been a PR person, I've worked for community groups and the labor unions. I was the PR person for Congressman Kucinich's presidential campaign in 2004. I started an organization 4 or 5 years ago now called After Downing Street, and you can go to afterdowningstreet.org to see what that's all about. And I'm traveling around the country, going to 50 cities, and will be in Grass Valley on November 20th.
Wow. You'll be in Grass Valley on November 20th. Okay.
That's somewhere near you, right?
Oh, yeah. It's the neighboring town.
Yeah. Well, there's a Unitarian Universalists building there, 246 South Church Street, 7
right.
p.m. November 20th.
Okay, you've written a book which I've had a chance to peruse. I found it fascinating. It's filled with terrific ideas. One section that especially caught my eye dealt with our need for a second Bill of Rights. In it, you list rights we need but presently are not in our Constitution. Would you like to give us some examples of that?
Well, There are a lot of rights we can achieve legislatively and by joining international treaties, which we are one of the few nations to be a holdout on in many cases. But ultimately, it would be ideal to amend our Constitution, assuming that we could do it without making it worse rather than better, which requires some reforms along the way before we make that happen, or very careful bit-by-bit amending of the Constitution. But
okay, we'll get into that a little bit later. One of the freedoms that I found interesting, freedom from war lies. I thought that was a very interesting right that we don't have. Would you like to explain that a bit?
Sure. It's something where I would consider actually drawing a limit on freedom of speech, aside from stripping corporations of the supposed freedom of speech to bribe our elected officials with money, which is not speech. War lies, blatant misleading of the public in order to take us into war, I think ought not to be protected as free speech. That is to say, when our government feeds us with false information in order to build support for a war, that is arguably worse than shouting fire in a crowded theater. And there have to be reasonable limits on freedom of speech. Right now, we have a great many unreasonable limits on freedom of speech. We don't have a legitimate freedom of the press and so on. We have to move everything in that other direction in a great many ways. But in that one particular way, I would certainly think that one limitation would be appropriate.
Okay. You mentioned the corporations and their freedom to contribute money whenever they please, and the reason that they can get away with that is this business of corporation personhood, that a corporation is considered by a Supreme Court decision to be the same as a person. How do we change that?
Well, it, it may be that we can't change it without creating a completely different Supreme Court or amending the Constitution. Sadly, we have court rulings now treating it as accepted practice, albeit based on a misreading of a court decision many years ago, that corporations have rights, that the Bill of Rights, that the human rights given to people in our nation also belong to corporations, that they count as people. And in many cases, we see corporations' rights outweighing the rights of real flesh and blood people. And we may see a decision from the Supreme Court any day now that takes away any limitation on corporations' rights to free speech, interpreting free speech as including, again, the spending of money to bribe elected officials, which, if that comes down and is unchallenged and becomes the law, you will see a level of financial corruption that will absolutely dwarf anything we've seen heretofore, and you're going to see an incredible moment of outrage and pushback. At least I certainly hope so. And it would be, it may become politically possible. It certainly must, if we are to preserve a representative republic in any sense, to amend the Constitution to do away with one or both of those, at least to do away with the idea of corporate free speech by spending money.
Okay. You alluded to the fact that if the Supreme Court decides in favor of the corporations, there's going to be a massive outcry. This leads me to the thoughts about activist groups. This massive outcry, from my observation, so far massive outcry hasn't gotten us anywhere. We had a massive outcry against going to war with Iraq, and here we are at war with Iraq. We had a massive outcry against the bank bailouts, and we got the bank bailouts. So, what can be done that puts teeth into massive outcries, and what activist organizations are actually achieving anything?
Well, one thing to look at is in trying to influence our government in Washington directly, stop, for God's sakes, trying to influence a president. It's hardly ever been done in U.S. history. It's very, very difficult, and yet you have all these peace and justice groups saying, call the White House, email the White House. It's largely a waste of energy that just leads to frustration. And the same thing, for the most part, with senators. But House members is where we have the most likely chance. And yes, it's unfair and slanted against us and absolutely outrageously difficult, and where they're corrupted by money and the media and the parties and the gerrymandering and so forth. I can't help you with the problem that the world's unfair and that this is a very difficult long-term struggle. But the most strategic place to go, because all of the others are worse, is to the House of Representatives. And to get activists in your congressional district together, working with good activist groups to go after your representative with key demands and enforce them. And by good activist groups, I mean, among other things, organizations that take their agenda from their members outside the Beltway, as opposed to what is the majority practice among so-called grassroots groups, and that is to reverse the procedure and go ask the White House or the leadership in Congress, what should we rally our members to lobby you for? Getting a pre-approved demand and then going out and treating people as props for rallies meant primarily to create bad news for a different political party rather than taking an agenda from the people to the so-called representatives in Washington. And when you do that, it doesn't mean that you can't compromise and back a piece of legislation or another step that doesn't give you everything you want immediately. But it means that you don't pre-compromise and self-censor and pretend that some lesser thing is what you want, which is the normal practice, at least on the left-hand side of the political spectrum, and typically leads to a compromise down from there to something even worse. So check whether and be active within organizations to make sure that they are democratic with a small d in how they go about lobbying, and when they are not, abandon them and create new ones as necessary, and be willing to lose politeness and as necessary address your representative in Congress by sitting in their office en masse and refusing to leave and bringing the media and disrupting the work of their office and their staff in your district. You don't have to go to Washington.
You know, I was just going to ask you that very thing. It seemed to me that it has to be up close and personal. One of the things that occurred to me is rather than demonstrating in the streets, we should be demonstrating on these representatives' front lawns.
Yes, enough with marching around on Saturdays in Washington or at home. Stop it. It wastes energy. We need to have sustained, nonviolent resistance where it counts. And so, you know, I applaud my friends who are going to health insurance companies to protest bad health care policies. But, you know, we can't hurt a health insurance company with a single one-day protest. We aren't going to generate the level of attention. We certainly aren't going to hurt their bottom line. But we elect our representatives in the House. We can unelect them. We can challenge them in primaries and general elections. We can impact them in the local media and make our own media, and we can disrupt what they are doing. We can shut down their offices with the emails and the faxes and the phone calls and our presence. Go there and sit there and cough a lot and bring television cameras. You know, we're in a situation on this stupid, godforsaken health care bill where we have enough commitments in the House to vote no, first before the abortion amendment went through. We already had 57, 60 members saying, you know, I'll vote no unless it has a public option tied to Medicare rates. Well, it doesn't, and only two of them kept their word. And then you got this STUPAC amendment, and now you have another 40-some members saying, well, I'm going to vote no this time if it's still in there when it comes back from the Senate. You've got dozens of Democrats saying, I will vote no for good reasons, and then all the Republicans voting no for their own crazy reasons, meaning that if any of these people keep their word in any significant number, the bill dies. We start round two in the unprecedented situation of the more progressive members in the House having to be paid some attention to. Never happened before. But if they all cave in again, as they did a couple days ago, as everyone expects, and pass a bill that's worse in any number of ways than what they swore they would vote down, then where are we going to be? What good is it going to do us to get commitments to vote no on war funding or anything else when nobody believes them? So we have to maintain the currency we work with, which is commitments from Congress members.
Okay. How do we take back our media?
Well, as you know, I go into some discussion of this in the book, and there are long-term solutions that are needed, and we fundamentally need to bust up this monopoly cartel, something that Argentina's government just did with their media. We have, you know, one of the worst systems in the world, it can be said now. We have a handful of mega international corporations.
Six, I believe it is. Yeah.
Yeah, controlling the vast majority, at least in terms of television, and interlocking board members, with other corporate interests.
How did Argentina do it?
Well, they passed through their legislature a law saying we will bust up the major media corporations.
Force them to divest?
And this is, well, I don't think so. I don't know all of the details.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that this is something that must be done and is part of our tradition, and we were not supposed to have monopolies from the start of this country, and we now do. We have them as bad as anywhere else, with a few exceptions, and we are a lot less aware of it than anywhere else, making this monopoly state media system so much more effective because so so few of us know what it is. But we have to, in terms of long-term solutions, we have to have free media for campaigns. We have to take away that biggest expense for the legal bribery system of the campaigns. We have to have public media and nonprofit media and community media and local media, and we need systemic changes to get there, and we have to provide every medium to everyone, so everyone has access to high-speed internet, everyone has access to satellite and cable and so forth. But in the short run, this is one of the areas where people can be most effective, even just on their own, without a huge group of allies or friends. And that is to say, support and build your own media and good media outlets like this one, and stop supporting the ones that are destroying our country. Every election cycle, we fund these television networks that are destroying our country through the political campaigns. We give the candidates money, they give it to the television networks. We could take a fraction of that and sit out one election and create a new television network that actually reported the news. We don't have the nerve to do it. And peace and justice groups take out full-page ads in the New York Times and brag about it. The New York Times, without which we wouldn't have the wars. We have to be willing to stop doing that. Stop going on Fox and sending the little YouTube around and bragging about it. Do not treat something that's destroying our country with that respect. Instead, build up good media outlets, however small they are. Build them up so they reach more people.
Okay. Most of the suggestions you have, which I found excellent, I thought it was a very, very well-written book, very well thought out. Most of the suggestions you have require one of two things. They either require changing our laws, which means going through a Congress, which in my opinion is not going to do that because it doesn't serve their own selfish interests, or going around the Congress. And the only means I see to going around the Congress is through a new constitutional convention. Am I correct in my analyses? Do you see any other path?
Well, I don't think you're incorrect, but I would quibble a little bit. For one thing, I am spending night and day, and have for many, many months since before I did the book, so I doubt the book completely disagrees with this, trying to convince people to get their mind off passing laws. The most important thing that we can do through Congress does not require passing laws, and therefore does not require the President or the Senate, and therefore allows us to focus our energies on the House. And that is to say, if we want to restore any powers to Congress, taking them away from the executive branch where they do not belong, we need subpoenas and we need impeachments. And those can be done with the House alone. And if we want to end these illegal, catastrophic wars, the House has to stop funding them, at which point the Senate and the President can do whatever the heck they want, but they can't fight wars because they don't have the money. And if we want to end a disastrous sellout of a health care bill and initiate a round two where we might do better, we just have to block it. And this is an important, it seems simple, but people can't seem to remember it for more than a day, and that is to block bad bills, which is primarily what we need to do. You only need one House. You don't need both. So we can ignore the Senate, which we can almost never influence anyway. It is very, very difficult. So I'm not advocating abandoning lobbying Congress and pressuring Congress. In fact, I'm helping the peace movement organize massive nonviolent resistance in Washington this coming March. But I'm suggesting that what we want to demand of the one branch of Congress we can most easily reach, granting it's nearly impossible, but most easily reach, it has nothing to do with passing laws. It's blocking laws, issuing and enforcing subpoenas, and impeaching members and former members of the executive branch. In terms of going around the Congress, absolutely amending the Constitution is part of a long-term vision, but there are strategies to go through the courts and foreign and international courts. There are strategies to reform the media that we've been talking about that don't entirely depend on Congress. And there is the important work of outreach and education that has to be ongoing. And doesn't have to wait for Congress.
Okay. Let me interrupt this time to tell our listeners that it's 12:27 in the p.m. You're listening to KVMR-FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. The name of the show is Rabble Rousing. Your host is Chamba Lane. And we're honored to have as our guest today David Swanson. He is the co-founder of the After Downing Street Coalition, and he's written a fascinating book called Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union. And so that's what we're talking about for the next half hour. Okay, lost my train of thought.
We're talking about Congress or going around it.
Congress or going around it, right. Oh, yeah. You mentioned impeaching, the impeachment process,
yeah.
And that has to do, my understanding is you can only impeach somebody that's in office. You can't impeach somebody that's out of office. You can't get to Bush and Cheney now, can you?
Well, there's a yes and a no answer to that question. The answer is no, in the sense that constitutionally and legally, and there is precedent for it, you certainly can impeach someone who is out of office. It has been done, and it makes perfect sense in that you could strip them of the Secret Service protection and the pensions, and you can impose one of the fundamental penalties of an impeachment trial, and that is barring that individual from ever again holding public office.
Oh, okay.
But the other answer to your question is you're absolutely right, because 99.5% of Americans agree with you and have no clue that you can do something. And when Americans don't know that you can do something, to take on the task of educating them and then getting them to lobby for it just makes that task infinitely harder, which is one of the reasons I think the name Jay Bybee is very important. Jay Bybee, J-A-Y, B-Y-B-E-E. Jay Bybee is a judge in California on the West Coast, the appeals court in the Ninth Circuit. He's got a lifetime seat there, nice comfy job, just below the Supreme Court, overturning the rulings of honest men and women in the courts below him. And he got that judgeship by signing the worst of the worst of the secret memos, the secret laws legalizing torture and aggressive war, working in the Justice Department for Bush and Cheney. This was the deal. You legalize these blatant crimes in secret memos, some of which are no longer secret, and we'll make you a judge for life. We impeached a judge earlier this year for groping people, and I'm not going to defend groping people, but if you cannot impeach Jay Bybee because he's a former member of the executive branch, and because Fox News would not like it, this is the excuse that comes out of the House Judiciary Committee and did on impeaching Bush and Cheney for years, then you can never check abuses of the executive branch. And Jay Bybee is and was a civil officer of the United States, and all experts agree that having switched from one office to another is irrelevant. So you don't have to make this argument about impeaching someone who's out of office. He is in office.
Okay, and he would be the poster child for impeachment.
Not just in a symbolic sense, because if you open an impeachment hearing, it's a privileged hearing, and nobody can say no to information. We could bring out the videos, the torture of Al-Qahtani could be on television. We could bring out the photos. We could bring out the reports, the internal reports from the Justice Department that they've been sitting on for years about what these lawyers did. We could bring everything out. And so you would put the fear of justice into the Justice Department if you just had a movement to impeach someone like Jay Bybee. When Alberto Gonzalez resigned, it was in part because committees were holding hearings and dragging him in, and in part, large part, because one Congress member put in a one-sentence bill that said the House Judiciary Committee shall consider whether Gonzalez committed impeachable offenses. If we get a bill like that on Jay Bybee and we start adding co-sponsors and co-sponsors to it, or if we don't impeach him and simply subpoena him and enforce it, you'll put the fear of justice into a White House and a Justice Department that have said these people are all above the law.
Mm-hmm. So that would be an excellent first step.
It would be a wonderful first step. I mean, we saw in April, Sen- Senator Patrick Leahy, the Judiciary Committee chair on the Senate side, look at these torture memos that came out and say, Mr. Bybee, would you mind coming in and having a talk with the United States Senate? And Judge Bybee saying, no, thanks. You go ahead without me. And Senator Leahy said, oh, I'm sorry, I bothered you. And that was that. There has not been a single subpoena issued this year. Well, in the previous 2 years, there were dozens of subpoenas sent to this gang of criminals that were simply ignored. It was all a pretense. And little known fact, any congressional committee has the undisputed power to enforce its own subpoenas and contempt citations with the Capitol Police Force. No committee has done it for the past 75 years, but now that you're at a point where the executive branch won't enforce your subpoenas, you're going to have to enforce one yourselves. And the minute one committee gets up the nerve to enforce a subpoena against a member or even a former member of the executive branch, the power structure is going to change dramatically in Washington.
And nobody in Congress has the huevos to do that so far?
They absolutely do not. They issued dozens of subpoenas during the previous Congress to people like Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice. Condi said literally, I'm not inclined to comply with that. And they just didn't comply. And what did Congress do? It kept issuing more subpoenas, keeping up the pretense. The Justice Department said, we won't enforce your contempt citations on these people. So they take the Justice Department to court, right? Imagine the most powerful branch of our government going to the third most powerful branch of our government to enforce constitutional principle on the second most powerful branch of our government. Absolute craziness. And the only thing they managed to enforce out of that is that Karl Rove, earlier this year, had partial compliance with a subpoena negotiated with the House Judiciary Committee by his longtime friend, the new White House counsel, Greg Craig. No taking of an oath, no cameras, no public, lawyers present, topics negotiated, transcript with approval posted later, and so forth.
So bottom line, they could have sat in there and played poker. We don't know that they talked about anything at all.
We now have a transcript, but we know that lots of topics that should have been addressed never were, and the public was not in the room, and there's no video.
So what power does the Congress have that they're not using? They could actually issue a subpoena, and if the subpoena was not honored, they could jail these people?
Yes. So, for the better part of U.S. history, up until 75 years ago, this was talked about by Congress members as their self-preservation as a branch of our government, the power of inherent contempt, meaning that Congress has the inherent power to literally hold people in contempt in jail cells. And you go back and read these cases, and they look sort of comical from an age of dueling and honor and committees having people forced to come in and apologize to restore the honor of Congress, which was thought of as something that had honor. And yet, in contrast to today, they actually cared. They actually cared whether their branch of government continued to exist. And so they did what is a pattern through U.S. history. They tried to strengthen something and weakened it. They passed a law making a statute of contempt and then had the Justice Department enforce contempt citations, which worked up until the point where you were subpoenaing members of the Justice Department and former members of the Justice Department and members of the same crime syndicate. Now subpoenas are not enforced, and now you have a new Justice Department, and you have a Congress of the same party, and all of these subpoenas were issued against the other party. What's the problem? Well, the president doesn't want these crimes looked into, and Congress members won't challenge the president, and the Justice Department openly is a servant of the president, not the law. So the new Justice Department is no more likely to enforce subpoenas than the past one, and Congress members are terrified of doing it themselves, so nobody gets subpoenaed, and nobody from the last 2 years gets re-subpoenaed.
You mean to say that even the congressmen that do seem to have huevos, Dennis Kucinich, Barbara Walters, Barbara Lee, Ron Paul, even these guys don't have the huevos to do these things?
Well, Barbara Walters, I think, is a journalist of some sort, but Barbara
Lee
Dennis Kucinich. I take your
Waters,
point
Maxine Waters is
oh,
who
Maxine,
I meant.
Yeah, Maxine Waters, yes. Well, there are a handful of Congress members who will do things that none of the others will. Dennis Kucinich and a new freshman Congressman Massa from New York are the only two who voted against the health care bill because they had committed to voting against one that bad. There are standouts. Barbara Lee was the only member to vote against the initial authorization to use force and attack Afghanistan and so forth. But to issue a subpoena, you need a committee or a committee chairman. Kucinich is the chairman of a subcommittee that might have jurisdiction in some of these areas, but he's not responsible for any of these subpoenas that were issued during the last Congress. The Judiciary Committee, the Committee on Reform and Government Oversight, Chairman Waxman, who notably abandoned that committee at the instant that he might have gotten anywhere in this new Congress, and made pretty clear that he thought oversight would not be needed anymore. These are people who sent out dozens of subpoenas in the past 2 years, and Senator Leahy and others on the Senate side, and they're not reissuing them. And people still think of Chairman John Conyers, who would not impeach Bush or Cheney because Fox News would not like it, who denounced this health care plan and then voted for it, as someone with a lot of nerve. He just isn't. He's someone with a lot of understanding and a committee staff that write books about Bush and Cheney's abuses of power. He's not someone ready to do anything about it.
Bottom line, he doesn't walk his talk.
Right.
Great talk, no walk.
Right.
Okay, so
it's a widespread problem.
Yeah, it certainly seems to be. Is it time to get into talking about a constitutional convention? Because, again, I see that we're not going to get very far. I mean, you've outlined the problem perfectly. Okay, we got to lobby Congress, but the leaders of Congress have very carefully handpicked the chairman of committees of people that don't have the courage to do these things. It doesn't seem like it's going anywhere.
Well, nothing ever seems like it's going anywhere until we get there. We are up against huge odds. For those who need success stories, they are out there. Having driven Alberto Gonzalez out of town was a nice one. Having made the Iraq War illegal through our protests to the United Nations, having prevented it being much worse than it's been, having hurt recruitment efforts, having thus far prevented an attack on Iran, having through recent protests probably stopped the army from putting Killing His Fun video game halls into shopping malls across the country, the a handful of citizens in the Czech Republic having kept a missile defense base out of there, you know, local and state and national victories, they are there if you look for them. Nobody will tell you about them on television. You have to declare them yourself. But, you know, we also have this very self-indulgent attention span. You know, it means that in long-term struggles for justice, like the one that created the Constitution in the first place, you know, you just have to get down and struggle and fight and not worry about whether you're going to win this month. And you know, the people most responsible for women being able to vote never saw a woman vote. The most people most responsible for ending slavery never saw slavery end, and so forth. So at some point I have to say, you know, it's just not relevant whether we're hopeful or discouraged. We just don't have that luxury.
Got to do it anyhow.
We've got to do it, so let's do it. But then how to do it most strategically, absolutely, that is a mm-hmm. a worthwhile question.
Okay.
And so having at least a long-term vision of how to amend the Constitution, to give ourselves the right to vote that could be enforced, that we could be, you know, registered to vote the same minute we're registered to go kill and die in wars, that we could have a national verifiable standard of elections where you vote on an actual piece of paper and it's publicly counted in the polling place and we know whether we elected the person we elected and so forth. We have to have these goals, but then some of them we can get to through the states before we get to them nationally, and we can get to them step by step before we get to them entirely. And so we can pick battles along the way toward our long-term vision. I think if we get a serious healthcare system, it's going to be in a state. And California has passed a decent bill twice and is likely to again with a different governor in place. And you know, if miraculously we could force an amendment to facilitate states being able to have that right into the national bill, which Congressman Kucinich had put in and it passed a committee and Nancy Pelosi stripped it out, we would help that along. There are a lot of things we're going to get to at the state level first.
Okay. Let's jump in thickly in the water. Let's talk about a constitutional convention, and let's preface that by the argument that the Constitution was perfect when it was founded, and they didn't anticipate changing it. That, of course, isn't true.
That is a rather common understanding. You know, I go around the country. I mean, I'm roughly halfway through this tour of 50 cities, and a lot of times I've asked, raise your hand if you know what Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution is about. And more often than not, I don't get a single hand. And yet, everybody spends all of their activism on electing people who swear an oath to this document, and a lot of people think it's so sacred they don't want to consider the possibility of altering it.
Exactly.
They have no idea what's in it, and the people who wrote it, got a lot of things wrong that I'm glad have been changed, a lot of things that need to be changed. By no means a perfect document, a very, in many ways, anti-democratic, aristocratic, wealthy, white male document that needs improvement. But they did it with a great deal of democratic spirit, small d, and humility, and they built in ways in which we could change it and expected it to be changed.
I think that's the important thing. They expected it to be changed.
They did, indeed. And Thomas Jefferson, whose house I can see here out my window in Virginia, said that we might as well wear the clothes that you wore as a child, as, you know, treat a document of your ancestors as up to date. You know, times change and evolve and progress, and the document needs to be advanced. And in fact, what was a cutting edge system of government so many years ago, 222 years ago, it may be the most influential, is now dragging behind. Many other nations have more advanced constitutions, and many international treaties that we have not signed or ratified or enforced go beyond our Constitution. And the only reason I hesitate to focus entirely on improving our Constitution is that we aren't even enforcing what we've got. And so there's not much point in making it better if we aren't going to enforce it. But we have to do both.
Okay. Let us take the fork in the road that says we want to have a constitutional convention and redo the Constitution. I would like you to explain the mechanism, how we go about achieving that, and what are the dangers that we need to avoid.
Well, there are two ways that you amend the Constitution. One is simply through Congress, and there are two ways that you set up a convention, which has yet to be done.
Excuse me, let me interrupt.
Sure.
When you say you do it through Congress, that means the House of Representatives, but doesn't the Senate and the President have to agree?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Well,
this is not one of those, the House can do it alone.
Okay, so as we've already discussed, that ain't going to happen.
Right. I'm just telling you the options, not swearing they are realistic options.
Okay.
You can do a single amendment. Imagine it becomes politically viable that the outrage is absolutely overwhelming, that we're going to deny corporations personhood or free speech rights. You could pass that amendment through the Congress. If you look at Article 5 of our Constitution, which says how you change the Constitution, it's a very short article. It says when two-thirds of both houses, so you need more than a majority, propose amendments to this Constitution, or two-thirds of the legislatures of the several states call a convention for proposing amendments. In either case, when ratified by the legislatures of three-fourths of the states, or by conventions in three-fourths of the states, then you've amended the Constitution. So you're talking, just to get the process started, you're talking about two-thirds of Congress or two-thirds of the states. Obviously, two-thirds of the states is going to be easier on a lot of things than two-thirds of Congress, but not exactly easy. The advantages are you can organize and energize people around serious reform without compromise and without it being written by corporate lobbyists. The danger is, of course, that we have a system so corrupted by corporate lobbyists and by corporate media and by party dominance that we risk opening up our Constitution to being rewritten by Lockheed Martin and AT&T, and we open up the possibility of, you know, Article 1 of the Constitution requiring that you purchase outrageous health insurance, and Article 2 requiring that all your money go to Wall Street bankers and so forth. We don't want to make the thing worse.
Okay, so let me float a very simple idea and see if you think this will fly. Rather than having a convention that tackles a huge body of work, much of which is going to be controversial, could this be done on single issues? For instance, could individual states get together and say, we want to end this corporate personhood, and get two-thirds of the states to agree? And
Yes. You get two-thirds of the states to agree just
on that single issue.
Okay. And you limit... you limit it just to that, and you pass it, and then you get three-quarters of the states to ratify it.
And then it's done. So it seems to me that it might be most expedient to do it the slow way and do it single issue, because it's the only way to do it.
At the moment, it certainly is, although perhaps even more expedient is to do it at the state level. I'm not against pushing both at once, and will be part of doing so. I think there's a coalition of good groups getting together to push back the minute this ruling comes from the Supreme Court. But, you know, local cities and towns and counties and states can do things that have influence that pushes up, and there are cities and towns passing measures stripping corporations of rights and personhood, and that's very helpful. It builds the climate and the pressure from the bottom up in a way that just individual citizens can't, and it's possible that we get to the point of having a Supreme Court rule in a sane manner.
Possible. So one of the ways would be, now California is a state that has the initiative process, so it would be possible to promulgate an initiative that stripped corporations of personhood in the state of California?
I think it would be.
Okay. And that would be a beginning, and then try and get other states to do similar things. When you've got two-thirds of the states doing that, then you're in a position to change the Constitution? Does that work the way it works?
Well, if you have two-thirds of the states having already done it themselves, then it's very likely that you're going to be able to get two-thirds of the states to propose doing it nationally. Absolutely. I think we may see an instant in the coming days or weeks when it becomes very useful and possible to energize millions of people around denying corporations the right to free speech through bribery. And it may be that on that point alone that corporations don't have free speech rights, only people who speak do, that we can move something very quickly.
Okay. I want to interrupt at this moment because some of my listeners are in lunch hour and they won't be able to hear the end of the show. And so I wanted to remind listeners that you're going to be speaking in person in Grass Valley. When and what time?
This is in Grass Valley at the Unitarian Universalists Church at 246 South Church Street.
In this Grass Valley.
Okay. In Grass Valley at 7 p.m. on November 20th.
7 p.m. November 20th. Terrific. Okay. We've got a few minutes left. What is it that you haven't said you want to say?
Well, I would just re-stress the point that as much as I want to improve our laws, if we don't enforce them, there's not much done by improving what they are on paper. And right now we're in a situation where top officials, current and former, openly operate above the law. We have a White House that makes laws. The recently departed president and the current president make laws with signing statements, rewriting bills, make laws with executive orders, treat secret memos legalizing blatant crimes as law, dictate to Congress what the laws should be, and openly announce that top officials must be immune from prosecution. They cannot be held accountable. We just saw an Italian court convict 23 Americans for kidnapping a man in Italy and sending him off to Egypt to be tortured. And the same week, a U.S. court ruled that a Canadian kidnapped by the U.S. and sent off to be tortured was not a crime. It's not kidnapping if you call it rendition, and we cannot endanger national security by holding our top officials accountable for kidnapping people and sending them off to be tortured. So we have to undo this idea of one class of citizens making our laws and operating above them, and the rest of us having very little to do with making them and being subject to them. And that means forcing the Justice Department to act, or forcing accountability through civil and local and state and foreign and international suits, or forcing Congress to take up the matter through its checking powers of subpoena and impeachment.
Okay. We had a caller and we lost him. But
I'm sorry.
If the caller is willing to phone back, we'll entertain a call. The numbers are okay. We got him. Caller, you're live on KVMR. Caller, you're live on KVMR. Caller, you're live on KVMR.
Hello?
Yeah, you're live on KVMR.
Hi, David and Chamba. I just wanted to remind everybody that David will also be speaking in Sacramento on the evening of the 21st. And if you go to David's website, you can find the address and all that contact information.
Terrific. So give us that website.
David's website.
Go to davidswanson.org or afterdowningstreet.org, and you'll find all the details.
Okay, so David is speaking in Grass Valley on November 20th and in Sacramento on November 21st. Thank you for that heads up. Caller, you're live on KVMR.
Hi, Chamba. We're just wondering what we can actually do now as citizens to help create some of these changes that David's talking about.
Great question. David?
Go to afterdowningstreet.org and the part of it that's at prosecutebushcheney.org, and you will find a great many things that you can do. But I would suggest top of the list, go to your Congress member and ask them to introduce a one-sentence bill that says the House Judiciary Committee shall consider whether Jay Bybee has committed impeachable offenses. And as Jay Bybee works in courthouses in your part of the country, check out information on the same websites on how you can join in going and protesting him directly, as well as some of his colleagues, including the infamous John Yoo, who works at the University of California, Berkeley.
Terrific. Thank you. Okay, any further? All right, we've got time for one more caller. Caller, you're live on KVMR. Please be brief.
Hello. I agree with your guest about talking to my congressman, Dan Lundgren, here. He's our former state attorney general. I've contacted him like six times about the health care bill. He never sends a response. Now, he and our other local congressman, Wally Herger and Tom McClintock, they're being funded by nonprofit corporations. Do the nonprofits, like the Mormon Church, have a say in how our government is run?
Clearly they do, and anyone who's giving money gets influence. People don't give money for nothing. We may see corporations given the power any minute now to swamp all money we've seen thousands of times over, and it will be a very different world in terms of financial corruption. But right now, typically, the biggest wheeler and dealer of money, the biggest donor to any Congress member's campaign, is their party. And so the influence of the party leaders is magnified by the financial corruption, so that it is almost impossible for a congressman or woman to listen to his or her constituents when their party leader is saying, no, don't do that. And to suggest that a committee that they are not a member of, but that is chaired by a member of their party, do something, is very difficult. But it is absolutely morally necessary, and it has been done. And Congressman Robert Wexler's constituents last year convinced him to publicly lobby his own chairman of his own committee, the Judiciary Committee, against the wishes of his party, to impeach Dick Cheney. And so such things can happen.
Okay. I'm sorry we're out of time.
Separation of church and state when the Mormon church is a funding...
Okay, I'm sorry we're out of time.
I agree with the caller.
Yep, unfortunately. Okay. David, thank you for a very interesting show. We're out of time.
Thank you. I very much appreciate it. Look forward to being there.
Okay, so people that want to interact more with David, hear more of his ideas, 7 p.m., November 20th, in Grass Valley at the Unitarian Universalist Church, and the following night in Sacramento, and I'm not sure where it is in Sacramento, but you can go on David's website. Give us the websites again. David, you there? Nope, he's gone. Okay, afterdowningstreet.org or .com.